Hey everyone, Ray Robinson here, host of the Unsensitive Podcast. You're probably wondering, what does unsensitive mean? Well, it's a completely made-up word to define a topic that is insensitive to talk about at family gatherings and parties, but you talk about them anyway. New episodes drop every other Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, part of the Fearscape Media Network.
There is no question that something is here, lurking somewhere in the darkened corners. But how will we ever find out what it is? We need to look, always, and never stop. No matter what stands in our way, no matter what others may think. Explore the darkness. Shine light into it. Join the red strings and the silver threads. Everything is connected, somehow. I am Mark L. Watson. This is Peer Beyond the Veil.
I used to get put to bed, obviously, by my dad, and he used to tell us stories. He used to tell us spooky stories, which I thought was quite strange because I was quite young at the time. However, I got a thrill out of them. I thought they were really great. And he told us one in particular about this boy that used to live in my bedroom. And unfortunately, obviously, before we moved into the house, he lived in my bedroom, and he was killed on the... there's an electric railway line which used to run behind the back of our house, and he got killed, electrified on the railway line. And then years later, my dad said he used to put with a bed, and then when he used to go downstairs and watch the television, like half an hour or so would elapse and he would hear footsteps running round upstairs in the bedrooms, and that, and he'd yell up the stairs, get to sleep, the periods. So I've got an older brother who slept in the other room. And he never heard any reply from us, so he'd come upstairs and check to see if we were asleep, which we were. And on one occasion, he said he walked through into the main bedroom, looked down onto the railway line after hearing these footsteps, and he said he saw this boy walking on the railway line. But he said he never thought anything of it at the time until like a couple of weeks later. And then he had realised that the night that he heard the footsteps upstairs running round, and he saw the boy on the railway line, was actually the anniversary of the little laddie's death. And these are the stories he would tell me, and they would keep us rooted into me bed. I would be too frightened to get up and mess around, and I want to go to the lavatory or something like that, and I would just stay there rooted, and then I would end up falling asleep. But it was years later when I got into the ghosts and things. I pulled my dad up once, and I says, "Did you remember them stories you used to tell me about this boy in upstairs in my room? And was that a bedtime story, or were you telling the truth?" And he went, "Oh no, son, it was a true story." And I was thinking, "Well, what on earth were you telling me that for? At that age, and he said, "Oh, it's an absolutely fascinating true story," which I found to be absolutely amazing. And there was that story, and there was another time when I was a teenager this time. And I was lying asleep in my bed in that same bedroom. And I was very hot. It was one of those hot summer nights. So I decided to, obviously, I took my T-shirt off and the rest came off. I decided to sleep, you know, commando, as it were. It was really hot. I had all my windows open. And in the middle of the night, I kind of woke up and I just had this impression that somebody was, like, looking at us. But at that point, my bed was facing this way under the window. The door was here. So when I turned round, I could see the door. Anyway, I felt there was somebody behind. So when I turned round and looked, I did actually see a figure of what I presume was a young lad standing in my doorway, just standing looking at us. Now, I couldn't discern any features or anything. It was just the shape. And I thought to myself, Well, that's quite strange. But rather than getting concerned over the fact that there was a potential ghost in my bedroom, I was more concerned the fact that I didn't have any clothes on. And I thought, well, this is a bit... So I remember sort of scrambling and getting my arms out there, and I found me shorts and I got my T-shirt and I put it back on. And then I lay back down and thought nothing of it. So I kind of must have been half awake, half asleep type of thing. And then I woke up the following morning, and it was like the classic Pet Sematary scene, you know, where he jumps out of bed and he's got muddy feet. I jumped out of bed and I realised I've had my T-shirt on inside out and back to front, and my shorts were back on. And then I'm thinking, and it just came back to us. I thought to myself, Gordon Bennett, I think I saw something in my room last night.
There are hundreds of thousands of cases of hauntings and ghost activity spread across the world and across time. We hear the tales of the things which go bump in the night, the whispers of the shadows who duck from sight just as our eyes catch them in the doorways and corners. We see the grainy photos, the questionable orbs, the video footage of the door creaking slowly open by itself. Some of it is remarkable. Some of it could surely be proof of something. Though much of it could also be explained away, debunked, at the very least, doubted. But occasionally, there is a case which cannot be disputed. A situation of a haunting by ghosts or spirits, the dead, the passed on, or by what we know as a poltergeist. Many would posit that such things are not indeed spirits of the once living, but separate entities entirely. When the great landmark cases come along, they're documented and studied and remembered throughout time, and the evidence and the happenings which took place during it become the next clues towards what exactly is going on. We have the case surrounding Bawley Rectory or Thornton Heath, the events surrounding the legends of the Bell Witch or the Black Monk of Pontefract, and the infamous Enfield Poltergeist. With a level of intrigue, seeming confidence in itself, and an unparalleled level of violence and intensity, none are more worthy of note than the case of the South Shields Poltergeist. My guest tonight was a writer and researcher of all things paranormal with numerous publications to his name, when he was contacted to help with the case. What ensued over the months which followed present a terrifying and inarguable case of torment and horror. It is with great pleasure that we welcome Darren W. Ritson to the show to talk about his work and the case, and to tell us how he was thrown into the middle of a whirlwind which left him no choice but to peer beyond the veil.
But I had another experience in that same room as well, when this time around it was like a cold winter's night. The window was closed. This is one of the details I have to mention, that the window was closed, the curtains were closed, and when I woke up, I could feel something actually blowing on my forehead. And it was like a cold, icy blast, just localized, if you know what I mean. It wasn't like the whole face being covered. It was just on the spot of my forehead, as if something was going. And when I woke up, I started like brushing my head and like moving my head, thinking to myself, what on earth's that? To the point where I actually sat up, put my light on. By then it had stopped. That actually quite rattled us to a certain extent, because my window was closed and I was in the corner of the room, and there's no drafts coming from anywhere, but something was actually blowing on my forehead in the middle. And so that was yet another experience I had in that house.
Do you know any of the history of the house?
The only thing I knew about the history of the house was the fact that the family lived there before us who had the little boy, and he was sadly killed on the railway lines outside. The house was around, I mean, it was built well before the Second World War, because there's a famous picture in one of the war books that's out in our area. And there's a house a couple of doors down from where we live, which had been bombed, and it was all collapsed. There's a famous picture of that. So I know the houses date pre-World War II, but I'm not sure, to be honest, when the house was
built. You weren't sleeping in the little boy's bedroom by any chance, were you?
When? Yes.
Was that your bedroom when you lived there may have been?
Yes, that was my room.
Yeah.
That's why I was taken aback in the early days when my dad said things like, there was a little boy who lived in this house, and in fact, this was his bedroom. He was sleeping where you are now. You know? And I'm thinking, Dad, what are you playing at? And I'm like,
that sounds cool, but
oh, you know what? I thoroughly enjoyed it when I think back. I was petrified at the time, and I was thinking, like, "Oh goodness me! Oh, there's this other experience, and this is terrifying. I've got to relay this one." Got put to bed one normal night. I never get stories every night, you know, but I can't remember if I got a story on that night or not. Anyway, I was lying in bed, and I always insisted on having what we called the stairhead light on. To let some light shine into the room, because obviously I was a bit of a youngster and scared of the dark. And I remember lying there in bed, just lying there awake, and the light was coming in through the bed. But obviously at this point, my bed was like at the other side of the room. So where the door opened, it opened to the foot of the bed. So if I wanted the door closed, I could just reach out with my foot, tap the door, and it would close. So basically I could see the door open, and I could see the gap between the door on the frame, and I could see the light coming in. And we had these stairs in the house where my mother actually still lives, and I still visit quite a lot, actually. And I like to go up and down the stairs and see my old room from time to time. Anyway, I was lying in the bed, and these stairs, I always knew when my dad was sneaking up the stairs to try and like catch me out, to see if we're out of bed or... And these stairs made certain noises. If you put your foot on one step, it would creak in a certain way. Then it would, you know, then you put a foot on another stair, then it would be quiet. And so you just knew the pattern of creaking and groaning that these old stairs made. And I heard, on that particular night, I heard the creaking. And I thought, aha, my dad's sneaking upstairs. He's going to try and catch us. So I think I better pretend to be asleep. So I lay there and I closed my eyes. Casey came in the room, and I heard the creeping all the way up the stairs. Got to the top of the stairs, and I heard the noise as it would make when you get to the top of the stairs, and I'm thinking, he's there, and I'm thinking he's really, really quiet, he must be like really sneaking up. And then the gap between the door and the frame, I could see the light, it was blocked out. So I thought, he's actually there. So I thought what I'd do is I'd jump out of bed and stick my head around the corner to see him. Oh my God, I'm getting goosebumps singing about this. So I got out of bed, looked around the corner. He wasn't there. There was nobody there. Even though I saw this shape sort of behind the crack in the door. And at that point, I kind of freaked out and I started screaming. I was looking around, you know, like what kids do. And it was that point I heard movement from the very bottom of the stairs in the living room downstairs. I heard like my mum and dad get up out of the seat. The footsteps came to the bottom of the stairs. The door opened, and he yelled up the stairs, "What's the matter with you? What's up with you? What's up with you?" And I was absolutely beside myself, because I was convinced he had sneaked up the stairs. I heard the footsteps, I heard the creaks on the stairs, and I seen the black thing behind the door. Push came to shove when I went to France, 1986. I went with the school. And on the last night, I'll cut to the chase with this one. On the last night, during the day, we sneaked in some food and drink, which we weren't allowed to do. It wasn't alcoholic, it was pure orange juice. But regardless, we were told no drinks in the dormitories whatsoever. Now, this building was a big, old, stale, Gothic-type building, and it had like old dormitories. And pictures of Christ were in abundance, and crucifixes all over the place. And obviously through the week we were there, there was loads of tales of ghost stories and kids being kids and scaring each other, which I thought was great because I like that stuff. But on the last night, I say, we spilled this orange juice on the floor. So instead of mopping it up, being kids, what we did was we picked up this bedside cabinet, which weighed a ton. Me and two lads picked it up and we carried it across. We put it on the orange juice, not thinking for 1 minute. If the teacher had come in, he would have said, what's that doing in the middle of the floor? We should have just cleaned up the orange juice. And in retrospect, I wished I had. We left it there and we went to bed on the last night. There was only four or five who were in this dorm. I was in the bottom bunk facing, the window was on that side in this bedside cabinet, which was mine, was in the middle of the floor. So I nodded off and I woke up in the middle of the night to hear this slow knocking sound. Like so. Just like that. And I woke up and I sort of rubbed my eyes and I looked into the middle of the room and I could see my bedside cabinet standing in the middle of the in the middle of the floor. And it was coming up on one side as if it was like sort of balancing on like on a weird angle. And as it was coming down, hitting the floor, that was making a knock. Then it was going up on the other side, but it was very ever so slowly. So that's what was making the knocking noise, as it was coming like resting onto the floor, then going up and then coming back down onto the floor. So my legs come off the side of the bed and I was like thinking to myself, I was only 13 at the time, and I was thinking, what the heck is going on here? So I rubbed my eyes a bit more and I lunged forward to take a closer look, and it just took off. It flew across the room. My French francs and my keys and everything just went everywhere. And it was at that point, the rest of the guys in the dormitory woke up thinking, what on earth was that? They got a bit of a fright as well. And by that point, I jumped up and I'd made a beeline to the light about 1,000 miles an hour, flicked the light on. By this point, I was actually crying my eyes out, petrified. My stuff was just scattered everywhere. Luckily, that was my last night in France, and it's just as well, because I couldn't have spent another night in there. I got home, thought about that incident for a long time afterwards, and that was when I really started thinking, I'm going to start getting some books and reading about this sort of stuff, because although I was terrified of the thought of it, I was fascinated in the same respect. These things have occurred to me. Why have they occurred to me? I want to experience more. So I got started getting the books, and Unexplained magazines were out and about at that time. And I was getting into things like the thoughtography. There was a guy in America called Ted Seros, I think he was called, and he put the camera out of his head. And all that sort of stuff fascinated me, and I was into UFOs. But the thing that did it for me was obviously the ghostly phenomena, phantoms, apparitions, poltergeist activity. It's always been poltergeist for me. I've absolutely...
Have you ever considered... well, you have considered. Have you ever made any advances in figuring out a theory as to why you yourself are maybe more susceptible to either experiencing these things, either whether you're a conduit yourself or you're just more open to it? You know, your conscious is just able to perceive these things clearer, or...
I have no idea whatsoever. My dad, he told us a lot of spooky stories. He's had a couple of experiences, which he told me as a kid growing up as well. So I guess my dad might have been tuned in. He might be psychic. I don't know. We're all capable of it to a certain degree, I think, some more than others. But I'm not psychic in the sense, or my dad's not psychic in the sense where he can like sense, oh, I've got a woman with us and her name's such and such. And he doesn't really admit, he's just open, I guess, to ghost sightings. He saw a ghost in his old factory where he used to work down in Hawthorne Leslie's, which is now St. Peter's Marina, down in it's like the plush, lavish area of the east end of Newcastle. There used to be a site there. He said he saw a guy working in, it was a ghost working in, I can't remember the name of the shop that it was now, but it was like a workshop that he saw this figure in. And he said he saw another time a phantom runner in Jesmond Dean or Heaton Park, which I've detailed in my Haunted Newcastle book. There's a couple of experiences which I got off my dad, which I've written up there. And I've got no reason whatsoever to doubt my father. And he's an honest, genuine man. And I've even asked him years later, is this why you're pulling me leg? Is there any truth in these stories? And he said, no, sir, I saw them. I'm convinced. So perhaps in some way I've inherited something from him, the ability to sense or see things once in a while if I go out looking for things. I've got to be careful as well. The early experiences were I wasn't looking for them at all and these things occurred. And I don't think I jumped to any rash conclusions. And I'm being honest when I say with a little shadow boy in my bedroom, I'll openly, honestly admit and say, well, I might have been asleep for that one, so I can't be 100% certain. But there was them other incidences where I was convinced, 100% that something really weird went on. Now, I don't know why I experienced the bedside cabinet rocking. I mean, there was a bunch of young teenagers in that room with me. I don't think I was, at that particular time, upset or stressed or any way, shape or form. But it was a single isolated, what I would call a poltergeist incident. It was actually thanks to Alan Murdy, actually. Alan Murdy, who's is the former head of the Spontaneous Cases of the Society for Psychical Research. He was the head up until a month or so ago when then somebody took over. Anyway, I got to know him years and years and years ago. And when we were talking about the ghosts of Newcastle, he said he had started a book on Newcastle and other commitments come along and he couldn't sort of commit to doing the both. And I said, well, I would kill to do the Newcastle book. So if you could get in touch with a publisher, tell him you want out and I'll just step into the breach and I'll do the Newcastle book for you. And he said, that's a great idea. I goes, on one condition, Alan, will you write the foreword for the book? And he said he would, so he did. So basically I started, that goes back earlier when I was a kid growing up, when I started getting into the ghost hunting and looking for ghosts, I would go to Newcastle City Centre because obviously I'm local to Newcastle and I would start visiting the haunted sites. There's like, there's a whole host of great haunted places like Newcastle Keep. It's renowned for its ghosts and its ghost hunting now. But back in the day, nobody ever visited the place and looked for ghosts. And I used to go in and I used to pay the fee to go in and I'd walk around and I'd have a look about and I'd take photos of the place and I'd go to other different places in Newcastle. There's a place called the Blackie Boy Pub, which has got a famous ghost story in. I went in there and I got a tour of the place. I went upstairs. I wasn't doing overnight investigations or any type of investigations where you're waving gadgets around and getting video cameras and trying to film stuff. I just went in with a camera and a notepad and pen during the day. And I would ask about the ghost stories and I would like take notes down and write them. And I said, can I go in? And I would go in with my camera and I would attempt to just take photos. I would down the corridor, like the main room and into the toilets. There was a toilet upstairs in the Blackie Boy, which had activity in there. There's like the St. Andrew's graveyard where the woman's been seen running through. And I thought there's loads of places in Newcastle where I could visit and take photographs in the hope that when I got my pictures back, which would normally be a 36 roll of 35 millimeter film, because there was no digital photography in those days, I would have to wait a few days and then I would rush to click on Shields Road. That's the photography shop, and I'd go and get, and then I'd sit there, I'd get outside and I'd be like looking through my pictures one by one, dead quickly thinking, have I got a ghost? Have I got a ghost? When I started getting the information about the ghosts and things like that, there was another little book I used to own called Dark Tales of Old Newcastle. And there was a story in there that fascinated me. And it was about a ghost on Newcastle Quayside is named a Silky because they used to wear silk dresses back in the day. So if you see a Silky ghost, it's one of these like fishwife type things. And there's a ghost of a Silky that like glid along the Quayside and then turned left up this little skinny alleyway, and it was called Trinity Chair. You know, some vagabond or some old-fashioned sort of scallywag was feeling a little bit promiscuous. Is it word promiscuous? He was feeling a little bit, you know, he wanted some. So he decided to follow this lady up, thinking he might be able to have a little bit of fun in the back lane with her. And as he approached her, she turned round. And when she turned round and looked at him, she had this shawl thing up on her head, but she didn't have a head. She didn't have this like face. And he actually like shrieked and ran away. And it's like a famous story in Newcastle. But that was more or less Newcastle. I thought to myself, well, I've got loads of stories to write up there. What I loved more than anything, well, it was a number of things. I loved to get out there. I loved to knock on doors and go into pubs and say, I hear you've got a ghost. Could you tell us about it? Has anybody seen anything? Back in those days, I mean, the world's went ghost mad at the minute. Now, everybody, you're the odd one out if you haven't seen a ghost these days. Whereas back in the day, when I was starting out, I used to get told off, go away, don't be daft. You know, no such thing as such things. You know what I mean? It's the other way around now. But even when I was researching these books, I'd never tell anyone I was writing anything up about them. I would just ask them first, "You got any ghosts?" Whatever. "No, I've got any ghosts. It looks like, you know." "Well, you know, old Betty the barmaid, she thinks she saw something." I'm like, "Oh, can I speak to her?" And then I'd get stories, and then I'd gather them up. And once I've got them, and if I thought they're deemed worthy enough, then I would say, "Well, I'm actually writing a book about the area in the history and the ghost. Would you mind if would I be allowed to feature it?" So that's more or less basically how the Haunted series came about. But it was largely thanks to Alan Murdy, who said, "I've got this book, and can you?" And I said, "Well, I'll take that over for you if you don't mind." And he went, "Well, that would be a great help." And then I said to the publisher, I went, "Look, I've got lots of areas, lots of places I could write up." I says, "Can I do one on Northumberland?" "Yeah." "Can I do one on Tyneside?" "Yeah." "Can I do one on Durham?" "I've done one on Berwick upon Tweed."
I mean, the history of a battle and war across the whole of that kind of northern part, Northumberland, and up onto what is now the other side of the border, albeit the border's gone up and down, you know, over the years, either side of the wall. There's extensive, hideous battle. So it's not surprising that some of that land is holding on to.
Yeah.
Soaked
in the blood of the past. Yeah. And assume around every corner there's a ghost lurking. I was sitting at work one day and my line manager disappeared. She went on her dinner. And then when she came back, she tapped us on the shoulder and she went, "My friend's daughter's got a ghost." And I turned and I went, "Hi, could you tell us about it? Who is it? What did she say?" She went, "I've just been on my lunch with such and such. And then she's been saying, like, telling us all sorts of problems that our daughter's having. Things are moving in the house and they're blaming each other all the time. Doors are being left sort of open when they knew they'd closed them. Things were being moved around. For example, things were being found in the bath and taps were being left on." And it all started off kind of slowly at first, and over time, they started getting a little bit, something iffy's going on here. Because they were like blaming each other at first. And why did you leave the tap on? Why did you leave the door open? And it kind of came to not a head as such, but there was one incident where they had this rocking horse. It was like a chaise little rocky horse, where they came in from being outside and it was actually hanging from the loft hatch by its sort of reins. And they were absolutely sort of terrified by that. And this is what my line manager was kind of saying. She's had things going on. And I says, "Well, could I contact this lady next time you see her? Ask her if it's okay to make contact." And she said yes. So I started emailing the girl's mother. And I was getting details from her, and I was keeping the emails, and I was like, for some reason, I just automatically kept all me. Well, it's not a case of for some reason. It was like I was very meticulous like that. So I think automatically I was always going to keep me notes. But anyway, I kept them, and after a while, I had about 3 or 4 or 5 pages of emails and things, and she was telling us about what was going on. And then eventually, she turned around and said, "Well, you know, it would be best if you actually spoke to my daughter." I goes, "Well, would she want to speak to me?" She says, "Yeah, because I think I'm like kind of looking for some help." She's starting to get a little bit perturbed by this. By this time, I had about 4 or 5 pages full of notes. And eventually she said, "Talk to my daughter." And I said, "Right, okay." So she'd give us an email address and a telephone number. So I give her a call. And I said, "Hello, is that Marianne?" Marianne's what we call her in the book. Obviously, it's not her real name, but we give them pseudonyms because they wanted to go public. Then they changed their mind, and they were scared, you know, after the whole deal. And eventually, they decided just to go anonymous, and then they just slope off into wherever it is you are now, getting on with their lives, which was great. Anyway, I said, "Hello, how are you doing? My name is Darren, and yeah, you've got these things going on in your house. She started telling us all these things. And yeah, I mean, you could hear in her voice, she was like nervous, and she was a little bit shaken up by what had occurred. And she was saying, you know, like, my mum's obviously been telling you bits and bats, but I don't think she believes us either. Eventually, though, her mother got to see stuff that was going on in the house as well, so she became convinced. So after a while, I thought to myself, well, look, I'm not going to come rushing in just yet. What I'd like you to do, if it's possible, is to just make a little diary of events against when something happens. Don't be frightened by it. Just welcome it. See, you know, shout out, great, something else, brilliant, and make a note of it, write it down, like the time, who was there, who witnessed it, like sort of the conditions of, you know, what was it like outside, you know, that sort of stuff. But you don't have to do like loads, just keep it basic, but just so we've got an idea of what's going on as you're starting to get a diary up. So I says, if you can you think of like what's went on already so far? So she said she would compile this little diary, which she did. And then she started like continuing to add to it every time something happened. And for that, she deserves a medal, I think, because I suppose when you're being plagued by something that's unknown to you and you're quite frightened, to keep ahead and write the notes and keep the times, and, you know, for our benefit, was a real good thing. So when we did eventually come in, we got these notes and we could actually take them away and study them and trying to see what type of phenomena was going on and see if this type of phenomena fits into this umbrella and this one fits under that umbrella. And so that's basically what we did. So after a month or so, I think that was June in 2006. But by then, it had been going on for about 5 months, because it had started in December of 2005. That's when it slowly started from the December, went into the new year, 2006. And then over a few months, it slowly got a little bit worse, a little bit more active, shall we say. I hear that word. But it became more increasingly active. It was sort of ramping itself up as time was going by as well. And I was saying to her, I was thinking, well, I'm convinced that what you've got could be like a poltergeist. That's what it sounds like. So I assured her, I say, as well, if it's been going on for this amount of time, then the likelihood is it's going to burn itself out relatively soon, because by the sounds of it, it's out welcomed its stay already, because they're normally finished by now. You're not normally this unlucky, shall we say. I said, well, just keep on top of things and see what happens. And then I think it was the July, yep, I got a call and it was like, will you come in? Will you please come in? Things are going off, yeah, left, right and centre. Things are still occurring. Will you come in and have a look? She says, it's driving us potty and we just want someone to come in. They'd already had like mediums in and like spiritualists from the nearby church, which didn't work. The mediums and spiritualists come in and they put a ghost in every room and all the way up the stairs. Yeah, you know, there's a man called Fred in here, and there's a woman over here, you've got one on the stairs. Oh, you've got a dog upstairs. Oh, they're lovely. But you've got angels coming down. And is that and the other? Not that I don't want to sound like I'm mocking these people, but to be honest, by the time they went, she was more frightened than what they were before they turned up. So I turned around and I says, look, I think it's a poltergeist. This was before I even went in. I thought, it sounds like a poltergeist. And I says, forget about everything what they have said. If you haven't seen anything, if you haven't seen the man in the living room or the man on the stairs and this and the other, just ignore it. The likelihood is they're not there. So that's what she did. She tried to sort of reassure herself and like calm herself down. I says, yeah, we'll come in. So at that point, I knew I'd had the case, and I thought to myself, this sounds too good to be true, actually. If this is what she says it is, this could be an active live poltergeist. So I've got a colleague who I'd known for a couple of years prior to that, who'd been on the circuit, on the talk circuit and lectures. And He'd been around for years investigating ghosts, and he had his own column in the paper, and he used to write a spooky column every week called Bizarre. And I'd known him from a couple of years in a research society which I joined, and I thought to myself, well, I might need some help here, because I've never had anything potentially like this. So although I've got an idea of how to go about and do it, I thought I maybe need to take somebody in who's been around the block a bit. So I called my colleague, which was Mike Hallower, and I asked him about it. And I says, look, I think I might have this poltergeist. Would you be interested in coming in? And he was like, oh, yes, please. Yes, please. And he did actually say, though, but Darren, I've got to admit, you know, after I told him what was going on, he went, sounds a bit too good to be true, son. And I went, I realised this, Mike, but I've heard it from a mother, I've heard it from her, things are going on, she seems pretty frightened on the phone, so should we go in? And he went, yeah. So it was that day in July the 18th, I think it was, we went in, we carried out the interviews, sort of got to know the family, had a bit of, tried to get a bit of a rapport going, a bit of a laugh, and say, look, whatever's happening, you've clearly got something going on, you're clearly frightened. So let's see what we can do. But you have to understand from our point of view, a lot of people pull legs, a lot of people, you know, do jokes and they wind people up that for whatever reasons. It says, we're going to be on the ball here. We're not just going to jump to conclusions. And you know what I mean? We're serious about this. And she was sitting there nearly crying, thinking like, oh, man, please don't think it's a joke, anything like that. There's something seriously going on here. So we basically wanted to satisfy ourselves and see something for ourselves, which is obviously every paranormal expert. I'm not an expert.
Sure.
But every paranormal investigator, that's what I meant to say. So yeah, I thought to myself, it's every paranormal investigator's dream to witness something like this firsthand. So we basically then turned around and said, can we stick around for a while and see what's what? So we spent about four or five hours in the house that afternoon. And it was only towards the end of the day where we saw in action what we then termed as the South Shields poltergeist. And that was the day that it's changed my life. I still think back to that first day, beyond into the case as well. Many days, many nights were spent there. Some of the things we witnessed, we saw, were just mind-boggling. And I still, to this day, I still pinch myself and I think, did that actually happen? Wow. And what happened was that afternoon, we went upstairs into the child's bedroom where she'd said a lot of the activity was sort of focused. And we made ourselves comfortable and, you know, had my little beady eyes on everybody. I had my eyes on Mike and Mike had his eyes on Mark. That was Marianne's partner. I was looking at Marianne and Marianne was, everybody was eyeing each other up, you know what I mean? And we were just waiting for something to happen. And then out of the blue, this little yellow plastic nut about an inch across, this little yellow round thing, which belonged to the child's sort of kit. He had a little tool kit, a little plastic box with tools in and a little hammer. And he used to go around the house fixing jobs, you know, for his mom. And it came out of there, or what we presumed it came out of there, because it was all tidied up and put away. This thing came flying, well, wherever it came from, it didn't come from any of us, it just came whizzing across the room. And this reminds me very much of the Enfield poltergeist when the photographers went in and the Lego was flying around all over the place. These projectiles were like flying across the room at breakneck speed. And one of them bounced off the wall and hit Marianne on the backside and she winced and she jumped and she grabbed a backside. Ow! She lunged forward and this thing fell to the floor and we excitedly jumped up. Whoa! Expletives, swear words. Couldn't believe what we'd actually seen. That came from over there. And then we were saying things like, well, He never moved. He never threw. Her arms were still, because we were trying to think, how could this have been set up if it had? Funnily enough, as well, we've got it on video camera as well, because we've got the footage of we're in the room and we're like filming it. So it's all played out on tape, and you can hear it ping, and you can hear it go ow, and you can hear the kerfuffle afterwards, the excitement. We said that something's been thrown there. Wow, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it as we speak. But as we were excitedly discussing it, this ghoul, toy ghoul, which was sitting on the side of the bench, slid off the bench. You heard it move across, and then it just clattered into the bin. So we had two incidences now, which we were like getting excited about. So we had the yellow nut, which was flying around, and whilst we were getting excited about that, this thing slid off the shelf and it landed in the bin with a clatter. And we were like thinking to ourselves, wow, just what on earth's going on here? And Mike was saying no, he was nowhere near that when that slid in, and it's all caught on video camera this first day. And there was a few other things that occurred that day. It was like this ball appeared out of nowhere and landed on the bed whilst the two of them were sitting on the bed, and the lad Mark jumped up with fright. Something's just landed there. And I picked this ball up, and it was actually quite hot, which is a weird sort of parallel with other cases, you know, some of the objects that are thrown around, sometimes it can be hot for whatever reason. And it was really warm to the touch. We actually had to apologize to Mark and Marianne because we were so blimmin' excited. We said, look, we know this is hell for you, but you have to understand, from our point of view, yeah, we've actually seen something happen now. So we've got an idea that something is going on, and we're quite convinced that yous didn't do it. So we left the house that day happy, excited, but kind of a little bit bewildered, and there's actually something going on here. So we went away that day. And we basically said, look, we'll be in touch. We're going to go away and we're going to look at our photographs and our film footage, and we're going to evaluate what's happened today. And we went away and we made all our notes, we wrote it down, and it just went from there, basically, for another 4 or 5 months or so. We were back and forth to the house, investigating.
Incredible amount of time.
Well, it is, considering it had already been going on for about 5 or 6 months by the time we actually went in. So every step of the way during the investigation, we were convinced it was at its peak, or it was at its coming to an end, sort of thing. Because we were thinking, it's got it. We were thinking, right, we've got in here lucky just as we've managed to catch stuff. So how much more we're going to get is going to be in the lap of the gods. We were thinking it's going to peter out and disappear. But the more we went, it just seemed to get more intense, and it seemed to get more stronger, and just things started spiraling out of control. And it was just the most exciting few months of my life, I've got to be honest. But for the family concerned, they were complete nervous wrecks by the end. Bless our cons.
Well, then comes the tricky part of it all, which is, you know damn well it's now there. But what are you supposed to do to help these people in this situation? How do you then move that thing onward?
We were under the impression that it was about to die out. We were convinced it was going to peter out and finish anytime soon. Because we were also thinking to ourselves, we're lucky enough to have seen what we'd seen so far. But then I was just thinking, it's just been my luck. We've just come in at the tail end, and we're just going to catch it as it's on its way out. So we were saying to the family, look, the likelihood is it's on its way out. You've experienced all this stuff. And by golly, we wish we'd have been right in from the very, very start to know how to document it. But it didn't. It just kept on coming. And the more we went, the more we investigated, the more we got phoned out in the middle of the night. There was telephone calls, and there was all sorts of things. And out in the middle of the night in taxis and going down to the house because they were too frightened. And it just went on and on. And so as it went on and on, we were just saying, well, look, it's going to peter out. It's going to burn itself out. We'll stay with you until it happens. You know, we're only a phone call away. We'll come regularly. We'll, you know, so you're not going to go through this alone. We're not going to cut and run and leave you, mainly for two reasons. One, we promised we would see it through with them and help them. First and foremost, that was our primary objective, was to help them. But secondly, we wanted to stay as long as possible to try and experience and witness as much of this as we could. Because cases like this, like the Enfield poltergeist as well, and like other famous cases, which if you're lucky enough to get in and witness a lot of the phenomenon, they don't happen that regular. These big cases, they don't happen that much. So we were like thinking, blimey, this could be a big one, this bit, it's going on and on. We need to stay in as long as we can, yeah. But our primary objective, obviously, was to help the family and see them through it, which we did.
Were there any kind of steps taken spiritually or scientifically to help clear it, clear energy, to move it on, to identify if it was a spirit of potentially, you know, a person now deceased that could be moved on, or what was the kind of conclusion to it, I guess?
Well, I think from me reading in my books, me learning that I'd done, and my documentaries I'd seen, even though I was relatively inexperienced in dealing with poltergeist as such, I just had a gut feeling. I thought to myself, this is a poltergeist, yeah? I don't think it's anybody coming in from the dead. It's no spirits. I don't think we need mediums, and I don't think we need spiritualists to, like, create circles and move on into the light and stuff like that. But Meg was a little bit towards the side that it could have been something like that. So during the investigation, obviously, we weren't at loggerheads, but there was some heavy debates going on between Mike and I in trying to discuss what was going on. And I was convinced from the outset that it was a poltergeist and it was going to burn itself out. And I didn't think there was anything we could do to remove it. Some folk beg to differ. They think they can remove poltergeists. I've always believed that you've just got to let them run their course, and then they'll peter out and they'll disappear as quickly as they appear. 9 times out of 10 they do. But this one didn't seem to. So it was going on and on and on. And eventually they got so desperate to the point, Mike had sat them down and he had said, look, we can do one of two things here. And he give the choice to the family. He said, this has got to be, like, stressed that it was their choice to do this. Because we were quite happy to just sit back and observe and help them through it by just being there for them. So Mike had said, well, we can either, option one is just sit back and let it burn itself out, which it will, or two, he can smudge the house with his sage and sweetgrass. Now, at that time, Mike was into Native American spirituality, and he said he'd had family members who were in, you know, descendants, great-grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers of, you know, Indian heritage type thing. And he was heavily into the Native American spirituality. And he said he had this clump of stuff which was sweet sage and sweetgrass, and he said we can light it, and it's supposed to be good for quelling negative energies and things. So that's your second choice. And before they had even finished speaking, do that, please do that, because they were desperate. They just wanted to try anything. So he smudged the house eventually. He went round and he did this smudging ceremony in the rooms. And for a week or so, it kind of quietened down. And then, as usual, it just came back with a bump. Came back with a vengeance, this thing. And it was just ferocious. It was turning the bedrooms upside down, and it was trashing the living room, and it was, doors were being slammed closed, and things were being thrown around. Carving knives were being thrown around inside the house, in the household. As there was one time, Mike had arrived on a visit one day, and Marianne come running out the house just screaming, it's gonna kill me, it's gonna kill me. And as he walked into the house, this knife just clattered off the wall and bounced to the floor, and it was throwing knives around. And it was, again, I'm getting and the goosebumps, like, but the hairs are going up, and it's just, wow, absolutely incredible. But then it took an even worse turn when it started sending text messages to the householders, threatening text messages, stuff like that. And later on in the investigation, on a night that was termed Grim Saturday, because so many terrible things happened that night, another ceremony was carried out with one of Mike Halliwell's sort of Native American friends that came in, and they did this thing called the Medicine Wheel. That was pretty incredible as well. But there's been a little bit of debate, really, as to, like, how far we should have got involved and whether we should have tried anything at all. Some people are like, it's like taboo. You know, you just sit back and observe and try and learn and document, which is one of the choices we give her. But they were desperate, and they actually turned around and said, look, please, could you try this smudging ceremony? And again, later on, like, say, the Grim Saturday, where the medicine wheel was sort of implemented, shall we say. This was after a couple of occasions where Mark was actually attacked and he was cut, took his shirt off, and he was sliced open and he was bleeding, and this thing was attacking him.
I think when it gets to that stage and it's your family and it's your children,
that's it.
Taboo is the thing, is it? I mean, it's a desperation point, isn't it, where you have to try something, and something like a smudging ceremony is fairly non-invasive process to go through. I have to say, I would probably have taken the same decision, to be perfectly honest, faced with that situation.
Yeah. But after the first smudging ceremony, it quieted for a bit, and they got a little bit of respite, which they were grateful for, but then it came back with a vengeance, and then it started cutting him, Mark, and it was five or six occasions he was just torn to pieces. And on the Grim Saturday night, there was about 10 of us around there. We decided to invite as many people in as we could, with their permission. And we said, look, we need to get as much of this on film as we can. If he's going to get cut again, we want it on film. And we managed to get it on film. Unfortunately, though, because we're protecting the anonymity of the family, the film footage that we've got, we've got to be very careful on how we sort of show it, if indeed we do. I mean, there is some footage that was released at the time. There was two pieces of footage released when the book came out, basically to help promote the book. And what we had to do was, we just had to sort of, the guy had a tattoo, and we had to remove the tattoo, if you know what I mean. And it was like photographs of this guy's chest all cut to pieces. And there was this weird bottle balance footage, which was very controversial, which Mike had filmed on one of the nights I wasn't there. This was the first night the guy got cut. Mike had went downstairs after all the hullabaloo. He said he would stay the night and not go home. And he was just sitting nodding off at the table. You know, there was cigarettes in an ashtray and this and that, blah, blah, blah. And he woke up and he actually saw this bottle of mineral water. If you can see this bottle here, it was like sort of standing on its side like that on the table. He was just balancing precariously. So he picked his camera up, he filmed it, and then he started pushing it and prodding it, and it was moving around, and it fell over eventually. But that bit of footage went to the Sun online, or one of the newspapers online. I think it was the Sun, actually, which we were quite surprising, but we were expecting a hatchet job off the Sun. But they actually reported the case quite well, and they told it how we told it, and they showed the footage, and the footage was up there for a month. There was a little bit of footage we could show, and we can't see, but a lot of the footage identifies the family. And the number one goal is to protect the family's anonymity. So people have argued with us and said, well, yeah, you haven't got it, you're lying. Yeah, he's a liar. You're full of this and you're full of that, and he's a money making this. And we said, it's whatever. So you can call it whatever you like. Prove it. Show me the footage. And I'm saying, we can't prove it. We will not show you the footage because it's going to identify the family. Well, we're not going to believe it. So we said, well, we didn't believe with it.
Don't
they? It makes no difference to me whether you don't believe the story or not, because we're not interested in massive fame or massive fortune or anything like that. Protecting the family was the most important thing from the media, finding out who they are. Everybody wants to know who they are. 15 years on to this day, there's a site dedicated to the area in South Shields. the whole area. And there's a Facebook page, and my book ended up going on there. And hundreds of people, who was it? I heard it was here. I heard it was there. Oh, is it the street down here? Is it the street down there? And I was just like, I'm not answering any of your questions, but tell me if I'm wrong. And I'm saying, well, no, it's just going to be a process of elimination, really. If I tell you it's not here and it's not there and it's not here and it's not there, eventually you're going to whittle it down and you're going to work out where it might be. And we're not giving you any clue whatsoever as to who the family are, where the area is. End of. So they're still very much interested these days. And I'm hoping that the family's still tucked away somewhere, wherever they are, just getting on with their lives, forgetting the whole sorry affair. Yeah. Because it nearly finished them, this thing.
So they're not in that home anymore then?
As far as I know, I have a funny feeling they're not. I'm not 100% certain. It was about a year or so after the case. They basically turned around and said, look, we're going my separate ways. We just want to forget the whole thing, forget the whole sordid affair. I got the impression it was like that we were kind of reminding them of the bad time they went through, even though we had them through, you know. So, sure. Again, it was a case of like, well, you're the boss. We didn't do anything without their say, so we'll put them first every step of the way. And in this final decision, it was like, we want to cut ties and go our separate ways. We were like, fine, absolutely fine. We will never reveal who we are.
The million-dollar and completely unanswerable question, but what are your poltergeist theories? What is it in your head? How do you rationalise it if you do?
There's a couple of theories in relation to the poltergeist. We've kind of come up with a new one, and it's there's a little bit of interest. Well, actually, there's a lot of interest. A lot of people have said it's a thought-provoking idea, but it's just an idea that we've come up with. Well, I'll go through the other ones first. Obviously, there's the discarnate entity, where it's like some sort of disgruntled spirit of the dead come back to wreak havoc. That's what the old words noisy ghost translate into poltergeist is noisy ghost. And that's one theory as to what it is. Another theory was coined in 1958, I think, by American psychical researcher William G. Rule, who was a parapsychologist in the United States. And he came up with recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, which is RSPK. And that's, in effect, the ability to unconsciously interact with inanimate objects, moving them around without even touching them. It's all done like with the mind. I've kind of termed it as like a psychic temper tantrum sort of thing, where the focus, whoever's in the house, is angst. They're angry, they're frustrated, they cannot vent anger in whatever normal ways. Some people would go to the gym and punch a bag. Other people would go to judo and throw each other around. Some people might go for a run. Some people may just effing blind and stamp on the floor. For some reason, some people kind of just vent the anger in the normal way. So it gets bottled up. Eventually, it's got nowhere to go, this pent-up frustration and anger. And eventually, it's sort of like a boiling kettle when it boils and it blows off some steam. It gets externalized, this alleged energy, as RSPK. And that's when things start throwing around. It's like someone's having this psychic temper tantrum, but they don't even know they're doing it, if you know what I mean. And this is what William Rule came up with all those years ago. And they've really only been the two main contenders for like what a poltergeist is. But then we wrote another book after the South Shields poltergeist, and we call it Contagion. We're looking at things when you go to a poltergeist-infested house. And then I come home to my family and I find my glass moving along the bench or the door slams. I've brought a little bit of the poltergeist home with me, albeit it's like a diluted form, and it's called Contagion. And I'm not the first person to have noticed it. It has been noted in other cases and it's even been mentioned, but it's been very seldom sort of looked at and studied in sort of in depth. And we wrote a book about it. And we've come to the sort of conclusion that what idea is, because there's so many other cases with parallels which are so specific to other cases, it begs the question, rather than being one poltergeist here and one poltergeist there and another one down here and another one 20 years ago there, could it be one arch poltergeist, one superior super poltergeist, if you know what I mean? Like an octopus, it reaches out its tentacles and you know, it's got this like sort of parent body. So when there's poltergeist occurring here, there, and everywhere, it's just reaching out, doing its stuff. And as crazy as it sounds, well, anything in the poltergeist world, as crazy as it sounds, but we've come up with this sort of, I'm actually updating the book as we speak, to be honest. It's ready for it. It's going to go for a new re-release. And I've put in loads of brand new examples of other cases where people have like took the poltergeist home with them. So we're looking at poltergeist parallels, but we're also looking at the contagion aspect as well. So you've got the RSPK theory, and you've got the discarnate entity theory. And then we've come up with this. What if this is some sort of weird cosmic joke at play in its one big arc poltergeist? And rather than having loads of them all over the place over the years, it's just one thing. And it's been sort of accepted quite well at the moment. So, but then there's another thing we have to think about. During the South Shields poltergeist case, we go with where the evidence sort of takes us. We observed what we observed. And what it seemed like at the time was the RSPK seemed to start off because we found that there was a focus at the house who was potentially the focus. Obviously, it wasn't the youngster. In this case, it wasn't a prepubescent teenager. It was not like that at the thought. There was just him, her, and it was just his three-year-old. And we eliminated the three-year-old straight away, but it wasn't him. He was just laughing at everything. Everything was water off a duck's back for him. Even when it started picking him up and moving him around the house, it actually hit him on, I think it was two occasions. Stuffed him up in a blanket, put him in the cupboard. And when they found him, I mean, Marianne phoned Mike up one day and she was frantic. She went, it's taken Robert, it's taken Robert. And she was frantic. And she searched the house and she looked in this cupboard. And then Mike had said, go through the house again, I'm on my way. And she went back to the same cupboard that she'd previously looked in. And there he was, all bundled up. And he had, his eyes were open and he was like sort of in this weird trance. And he can't remember any of it. But
hideous.
It's absolutely horrendous. I mean, some of the things we went through, and we saw this family go through this, and we saw the tears, and we saw the stress, and we saw this family nearly crack up. And I don't blame them for going anonymous, because subsequently after the case, we received some horrendous abuse, absolutely horrendous, libelous abuse. And we're just so glad that the family kept out the way, and they've never had to endure any of that. We've just basically took the brunt of all that, and we're still getting it to this day. Absolutely, words fail me at times when I think again of some of the criticism and some of the abuse that we've had to endure online from people we knew, from so-called friends, and from people we've never met in my life. I don't care about the critics. I don't care about the people who we've never met who say we're liars. They can say what they like. We know what we experienced. We knew what we saw. And there's some top psychical researchers who were a part of the Society for Psychical Research. They were the only people I was interested in really showing the evidence to and having them evaluate the case. No one else mattered. And they stepped in, and Alan Murdy, who was the head of the spontaneous cases at that time, he come up and he interviewed us and we gave him footage and we took it away on the condition that it was kept prep, you know. And these people are like, they've got ethics and they know how to investigate. And he looked at the footage and he evaluated it and he took the photos away and he spent all day interviewing us about it. And he went away with the opinion that we were telling the truth. And I'll tell you why he went away with that opinion. That's because we were telling the truth. You know, this guy's a lawyer. He's a barrister in London. And I think we've had, you know, 20, 25 years of stand up in court. I think he can spot a liar when he sees one.
You'd think, wouldn't you?
You would think. And we didn't know he was a lawyer at the time. He came up and he said, I'm from the SPR. Nice to meet you, Alan Murdy, you know, et cetera. And I'm going, all right, yeah. You give us a Newcastle book, you know. It was in the early days of getting to know him. And we were sat there and we just discussed the case all day. But not only that, we had lots of incidences to tell him. And he went away happy thinking like, well, these photographs, the XF data on these photographs back this and this backs that. And the video footage suggests that this went on. He's got no doubt there was a case. He's got no doubt what we told him was the truth. And he did a review for the Society's journal. It's like a peer-reviewed academic journal, and they do book reviews and case reviews. And they put that in. And I was allowed to publish that in the back of the update of the book. So people can actually see that the evidence was looked at. It has been viewed. It has been scrutinized, and an investigation into the investigation has been carried out. And we've come out on top, basically, saying like...
By the oldest parapsychological organization in the world. So,
they can say to me, they're the people that are happy with what we did. So we must have did something great. So anybody else's critique, I don't really care about.
Sure.
You're an liar. You made it up. You're in it for money. So, well, we're not. You know what I mean? We're not. With the family are greedy, this and the greedy media whores. We've had that. And it's like, really? Could you show with the newspaper articles that went in?
Yeah. Even know their real names. Yeah.
No. They've just sloped off into anonymity. And 15 years on, they're still there. So that says a lot about how much they really wanted fame and money, doesn't it? I rest my case. What's coming up next? Well, the first thing I might add is the book, The South Shields Poltergeist, third edition it is now, is available on amazon.co.uk, Waterstones online, WH Smiths, all online. You can get them anywhere on the internet, all good bookshops, things like that. Or alternatively, you can go to www.thehistorypress.com. I think that's the website. You can buy it direct off the publisher, but most people just go to Amazon and get it off there. So that's where I would recommend you go and get the book. What's next? I'm updating my Contagion book, Contagion in the Shadow of the South Shields Poltergeist. That was my book detailing the parallels between all these different cases and taking stuff home with you and coming to our conclusions about this super pult, this one orc poltergeist, as opposed to being loads. Which I have to say is creating a bit of debate. Some are for it, some are against it. But that matters not. What matters to me is a thought-provoking idea has been contributed and it's been discussed.
Debate's good.
Which I'm happy about, because I mean I might not be able to go any further with it, because I'm no super brain, I'm no Albert Einstein. I'm certainly not, you know, like an academic with letters behind my name. I think I've done okay for who I am. But I said, like, I've put this theory forward and I'm hoping that the big boys can go away and either dispose of it or use it, utilize it. But as long as I've played a small part, which seemingly I have, that was me goal. So I've kind of made a contribution there. I just hope it's worthwhile.
So Darren, thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak with us. It's been fascinating and terrifying in equal measure. Thanks for sharing your stories with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Peer Beyond the Veil has been written and presented by myself, Mark Watson, as part of the Fearscape Media Network. Music and soundtracks are credited and licensed to Purple Planet and to Kevin MacLeod, licensed under Creative Commons. All rights are reserved by our parent company, MLW Publishing. You can follow us at facebook.com/peerbeyondtheveil or on Twitter at peerbeyondtheveil or at peerbeyond2020. Please click the like and subscribe buttons when you see them, most importantly, wherever you listen to your podcasts. It helps us to attract the attention we need to keep the show going, to get the guests that you all want to hear from, and to help more and more people